Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and my guest is Michael Ondaatje. Michael Ondaatje's new novel, Warlight, is published by Knopf, as his many recent books have been. But you'll pardon me, I absolutely think it's a great book, a magnificent book, an entertaining book, a moving book, an involving book, a wonderful book. That sounds like high praise, because I mean it to be. Now, where in the world did this start?
It's one of those books where I'm not quite sure where it started. You know, I mean, most of the other books I can say, as an English patient, it began with a conversation between a nurse and a patient in a bed. But there was no real moment that kind of made me think of this whole thing. I just began with, perhaps, with that first sentence.
It's a glorious first sentence. Will you read it to us, please?
Yep.
It's a first sentence that makes you want to read or write an entire book.
Well, that's what happened to me. Here it is. In 1945, our parents went away and left us in the care of two men who may have been criminals.
Yes, and I think that when you say you don't know what started this book, I think it's because Cat's Table was such a romp, such a spree, such an acrobatic entertainment, something that you hadn't really tried before in that kind of way. And what you did in Warlight is to write a novel whose first half is a spree. I couldn't stop being amused by it. I met greyhound smugglers. I went into the laundry room of a great big hotel where the men working get so sweaty that they end up putting their own clothes in the dryer and ironing them before they go home. And then you turn the page to part two, and we see always with any spree, there's a hangover. There wasn't one in Cat's Table. This is the book of what happens when someone faces the fact that by embracing enjoyment and surprise and pleasure, he has been ignoring abandonment, loss, and sadness. In this great survey of London at night just after the war, the nighttime lights have not been taken down. It's Warlight. You can hardly see in the dark. It's, of course, London. It's foggy. It's dark. It's wartime is just ended, and we're told that war doesn't end punctually. War takes some time to end for people to get used to the fact that the horrors of war are over. And so all of these austerity measures are still in place. These children, as we hear in the very first sentence, have been abandoned to be raised by what must be criminals. Among the things that lovely criminals do is to let you go out to eat all the time, to stand on line and get your food from the barrows in the street. One of the criminals, the moth, leads a hasty life. He is not about to prepare cooking for these children don't like being away at school. Well, okay, come back home. Eat at night from the barrows. I'll check in on you. Nothing seems to have the weight it would have if parents were around. Only what it would have if criminals were raising you. And the two criminals are mainly the moth and the Darter. Am I remembering that?
That's right.
And they bring with them a whole array of types. British types, old opera singers fill the house, but they don't know where their parents are. And their father, they believe, is in Singapore. Their mother, they thought, was going to Singapore, but then...
Well, and then they discover the suitcase that they had packed with the mother for quite a long time. It's a long scene of her describing every object she put into the suitcase for tea dances and so forth. And then a month or two later, the sister, Rachel, finds this trunk.
And they realize that wherever she is, if she's gone to Singapore, she's taken none of her things. And she's somewhere, but not in Singapore. So the young boy, our narrator, believes she must be in Singapore. She's our father's wife. What could she be doing if not with him? He doesn't understand that his mother could possibly have a life of her own, or a life without his father. And so their youth is a touching quality that leads them to misunderstand almost everything that happens to them.
What happens, of course, is that sense that abandonment sounds ominous from the very first sentence, but of course abandonment can lead to great freedom. And of course, especially Nathaniel grabs for that, I think.
I found myself realizing that this is about the fun of storytelling. And when I read about the greyhounds and realized, of course, that Knopf has a borzoi, a greyhound, as its symbol, I thought, isn't that great that Michael Ondaatje, with his famous penchant for research, discovered that greyhound racing, greyhound theft, these are not bred dogs. They're coming from all over. They have no breeding. They have no bloodline, but they sure can run in every direction. And on top of it, they can be drugged. And so these races are cockamamie races that the criminals who are raising them are, get this, taking the boy and his sister and later the boy and his girlfriend out on a mussel boat to steal the dogs, to deliver them to trucks who will deliver them to racetracks where greyhounds will run and where the moth, in fact, will be wanting to place bets because this is the chance of a fortune that these criminal men could never make through crime, betting.
I know that they were a gift. I wish actually Knopf had used a greyhound at the front of the book instead of the borzoi. But we didn't think of that.
But I felt that this was like acrobatics. One surprise was going onto the shoulders of another. I feel that with the Cat's Table, you untied some kind of string and said, it's okay. I can have a good time writing a novel, and my reader can have a good time reading it. And it was a brand new Michael Ondaatje.
I think you're right that Cat's Table did in some ways lead to this, as opposed to where was this book, how did this book begin? I think you're right, you know, because that freedom that was there in that novel for the 11-year-old boy on the ship did lead to a version of that youth in England, and especially in England that was, in fact, very restrictive.
Yes, I think when we meet Nathaniel, how old is he?
14.
14, and by the end of the book, he's just past 28, I think.
Yes, that's right.
And his sister is a year and a half older than he is, Rachel. Like many younger brothers, his sister, Rachel, wants to escape from his, Nathaniel's, scrutiny. She's entering her experimental years before he does. She comes home drunk. She's a tattletale a bit. She gets home and said he almost got suspended for peeing in the sink, she says about her brother, who did almost get suspended for peeing in the sink, except that what we're told is peeing in that particular sink has been a school ritual for years, but the schoolmaster makes a speech in the auditorium telling them, "I've fought in war, and I have never seen anything as vile in my life." So we watch these two children growing up. They're at home without their parents. They're at home with criminals. The moth is a heavy man. There's nothing moth-like about him, is there?
Not at all, no. He's quite, has quite a paunch.
Yes, a friendly paunch, we're told, and reminded that it is friendly.
Yes.
And he is nice to be held by. Mm-hmm. There, you know, in any abandoned children's lives, there are nights of loneliness, and he's a good holder of the children. Indirection is the nature of this book. And the mother, as we've been told, I'm not giving anything away, has been doing war spy work early on. And she met the moth in the process of doing her observation and sending messages overseas from the ceiling of a high hotel building. Do I have that right?
That's right, the Grosvenor Hotel, which actually was used for that purpose.
And so it's a very interesting novel narrated by a child. His assumptions are something like our assumptions as readers. When we're readers, we're children. We don't know how to evaluate what we're being told. And so this book is a whirligig of surprises, tiny shocks, and great, an initial celebration and joy. By the end of the book, perhaps these children would rather that their parents had broken up. But at this moment, we don't yet know. Now, I'm talking to Michael Ondaatje about what I think is his miracle book, Warlight. I read it with so much elation and so much pleasure. There are balls, because at the end of a war, hotels are filled with people celebrating, which means that there are people like our child, Nathaniel, aiding the celebration, washing and cleaning and being brought by the moth in. And the moth knows what's going on everywhere, which means that Michael Ondaatje has to construct a masterful periodic sentence about everything that needs to be fixed from the roof to the basement in a hotel before a ball can take place. How many times did you write that sentence?
Well, I mean, I wrote it once and then I rewrote it numerous times. This is the thing. I mean, I think even in the first draft, it had that, I knew it had that huge span of, you know, the wood polishers and the medallions in the urinals, and all these things had to be changed daily. And so, but then it had to be tightened, then it became long again. You know, I had to celebrate it in some way.
These people are going to go back to where they spent their childhoods. They're going to re-encounter that missing mother and try and figure out what she was doing. Did she dislike them? Did she abandon them? Well, it seems that every single miscreant, every dark personage has been acting as an emissary of the mother, keeping her informed that her children, well, yes, another week has gone by and they're still alive. The background is the mayhem of soldiers returning home, everyone happy to be coming back alive, or mourned because they haven't come back alive. And the book takes us into a time and place that we really, those of us who don't really understand. Most of our wars in America, alas, Michael, don't end. They just continue somewhere else. This is a war that has ended, but there's all sorts of cleaning up to be done. But not only that, families are having to reestablish themselves. And we find out on one of the very first pages of Michael Ondaatje's War Light that he knows his mother really through a picture he has of her. Why don't we hear about that picture? It's really toward the very beginning of the novel, just on page 16.
There's a photograph I have of my mother in which her features are barely revealed. I recognize her from just her stance, some gesture in her limbs, even though it was taken before I was born. She is 17 or 18, and snapped by her parents along the banks of their Suffolk River. She has been swimming, has climbed into a dress, and now stands on one foot, the other leg bent sideways, in order to put on a shoe. Her head tilted down so that her blonde hair covers her face. I found it years later in the spare bedroom among the few remnants she had decided not to throw away. I have it with me still, this almost anonymous person balanced awkwardly, holding on to her own safety, already incognito.
Already incognito. So before our narrator is even born, there are pictures of his mother looking unknowable. And this is going to be his inheritance from his mother, her unknowability. And he is narrating this book as we discover, while he's been involved with all these sprees and pranks and illegals, he lives all alone now as he's telling the story of this book to us. He's lost everyone. He's lost everyone. And sometimes the great joy of the beginning of our lives leads to the great sorrow and emptiness of a life without relatives, without friends. There's a certain kind of melancholy that this book develops. Now, I'd say, therefore, that in this book, you get the best of both worlds, of the celebratory world and the world in which loneliness and sorrow are the dominant emotions. And we know that one is the consequence of the other. This sorrow would not exist if it weren't for the joy. They're cognate. They go hand in hand. And that's one of the extravagances of this book, Warlight, by my guest, Michael Ondaatje. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm. I'm talking with, well, the esteemed Michael Ondaatje, who this time round has written a novel that I think is his very best novel, at least as far as my own reading pleasure goes. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Michael Ondaatje about his novel Warlight, where siblings living in post-war London grow up without parents and are raised by a strange figure with a group of eccentric friends. That's just the beginning. You know, I would say that before the show ends, you should put in your order or call your local bookstore and get this book so that you can start reading it right away. In the course of Warlight, Michael Ondaatje mentions some things that do belong with it. The magnificent comedy by Ernst Lubitsch, Trouble in Paradise, is referred to, I think, twice.
Right.
Paul Muni's movie, I'm
a Fugitive from a Chain Gang.
From a Chain Gang,
right, right,
appears in that last noble line when he's asked how he lives, and he answers, before the spotlight fades on him, "I steal." Truth-telling at its highest level in the very last moment of a film. Lolly Willow, the Sylvia Warner novel, a great, great novel about, in part, witchcraft. Precious Bane. And I owe Michael Ondaatje, who has immaculate taste. Last time he was here, he borrowed my copy of the Radetzky March, so that when it was returned, I read it in a new translation. This is a book by Joseph Roth. He also recommended a novel by a writer who really is known for only one book. I went and read it. It's true, if Michael Ondaatje mentions a book that I'm not immensely familiar with, I'm going to go get it. It's called A Month in the Country. It's by J.L. Carr. Don't read these books until after you've read Warline. Because, you know, I assure you the pleasure of Warline, but there should always be more pleasure after the pleasure of one after another after another. Now, there's a terrible sadness that is at the heart of this book. We're not going to spoil the book for anyone, but any young person who's beginning to date runs the risk of fathering a child. It's an especial risk if he barely knows the name of the person he's been having his first encounters with. And so, what can I say except the implication that this is someone who doesn't know that he may have had a child, that accompanying his loneliness is the fact that buried under it, all of the life that he is not going to be able to have has been buried, that the undersea aspect of this novel is the loss of connection, when the first part has been about so many greyhounds, so many large opera singers, so many parties and gifts. Now, tell me, I think you didn't know that this character is going to end up bereft.
Not at all. I didn't know that. I mean, just to give you one example, when I wrote the scene with the mother packing the trunk, I had no idea what was going to happen, say, 20 pages later on, that they would find the trunk. So the shock of that, for the reader, was also a shock when I stumbled on it almost. You know, that seemed, so that, you know, a plot for me tends to kind of occur. It's not something pre-planned ever. And there's always, as a result, it's more shocking. You know, I mean, one plans something and then the writer feels more confident, perhaps, and so the reader can sense something is going to occur that's going to twist that around. But, you know, the research I did would occur gradually. So something like the information that we discover from Waltham Abbey was nowhere in my head at all. So I had Nathaniel and Agnes and the daughter going up those canals, and Agnes diving into a pool called Newton's Pool. And much later on, when I went up into those canals and went and discovered Waltham Abbey, I discovered this was where they in fact tested the bouncing bomb that became well known as a film.
The bouncing bomb, and it's also where gunpowder was manufactured and sent down the Thames.
Right.
It's incredible. You know, we're going to continue talking next week about this book, but I'm going to sort of end by giving you a taste. You see, Michael just mentioned Agnes. She's been called Agnes because they've been having their trysts on Agnes Street in a house that her brother, a real estate agent, has up for sale. And so he refers to her as Agnes, but he doesn't know her name. In fact, we don't really know many of the names in this novel. Nathaniel is referred by his mother as
Stitch.
And his sister is Wren, W-R-E-N, although her name is Rachel. We're not told why these particular nicknames, but we are told that we're living at a time where everyone, whether affectionately or out of wartime disguise, is appearing under a different calling than their actual one. And that, you see, it's not only the state of the novel. Just think of the number of characters we don't know until late in the book in Bleak House. It's not just the state of a novel. It's the state of war life. And it's very hard to understand that almost all these people we know are living in concealment because they're working for the war effort. And it can't be known. And so the war light is something that draws life itself into concealment. It's not just that you can't be out late at night. It's that the light is diffusing, the light, the fog, is a diffusion of identity. There's no daytime self that can be relied upon in this book. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I've been talking with Michael Ondaatje, author of the new novel, Warlight, published by Knopf. And I loved this novel. And thank you, Michael, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer, Michelle Escobar. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
Join me again next time on Bookworm when Michael Ondaatje is our guest.